Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Okay, well, I'm going to try to keep things down to an hour, so I might chop on the head two items which we did discuss on the BCC, and that was, just at the very end, and that's Mike Pence, which we didn't have much to say about, and the situation in the Scottish National Party, with resignations and referendum campaigns not going to go anywhere, etc. So obviously, I'm going to concentrate on Gaza and the whole Israel-Palestine Middle East situation. So just to begin, I suppose, where we left off last week, I remember that comrades were raising the question of why Israel, hadn't gone in, why the ground invasion hadn't started. Now, my explanation was, for what it's worth, that there were still bigwigs visiting. That might be the explanation. But what we have, excuse me, what we have now is, the beginning, that's what we're told by Netanyahu, who's speaking in Tel Aviv, of what he describes as the second stage. And I think it is worthwhile quoting his words. I think they do matter because what he's talking about is not as some armchair generals were speculating on, and that is a blitzkrieg of the Gaza Strip, which would be, you would have thought, feasible, easy for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, to do. Far from it. What he's talking about is inch by inch. And to show you that the second phase has definitely begun, this is not just some incursion. What he talks about is, we will not withdraw. So one already knows what to expect, and that is more, and I would expect more intense bombardment by artillery, missile, and from the air, but also the commitment to ground troops, not only in the form of armored bulldozers and tanks, but infantry. Infantry who will be dealing not just with a war on the ground, not just taking territory inch by inch, but going down underground inch by inch. That potentially could be extremely costly and extremely problematic for the Israeli army. What's going to happen meanwhile to the 2.2, 2.3 citizens of Gaza is anyone's guess. What the Israelis tell us is that far from allowing increased deliveries of fuel, food, medical necessities, they're saying that Hamas has got such stores and they ought to hand them out to the 2.2, 2.3 million Gazans. Well, my understanding is that Hamas consists, roughly speaking, of 15,000 armed men. And you compare that, and I'm sure they have got stores, I'm sure they have got fuel, I'm sure they've got medicines. But the idea that Hamas, in terms of its armed wing, or even as a government, so-called government, has got the resources to feed, to keep warm, to look after over 2 million people is just obviously not true. And it's for that reason why I think it was correct for the Weekly Worker this week to use the genocide word. I thought that Ian did a very good article in the Weekly Worker. And clearly what it points in the direction of is Israel presiding over a war in which it's willing to see not just thousands, but potentially tens of thousands and potentially more than that die. People will be dying of transmittable diseases. It's not just a question of old folk and people who are newly born. None of us can survive without clean water. All of us will succumb to transmittable diseases unless we have, sanitation. So what Israel is committing or looks like it's contemplating is a genocidal operation. So this isn't simply some police operation. I always remember at the beginning of the Gulf War, BBC and the Americans in particular used to delight in showing us pictures of Baghdad with what was then called smart weapons. There you are, there's a building, we're aiming for that, and boomf. No one told us about the half a million or so Iraqis that died in that war, not only directly in terms of missile hits, artillery hits, tanks, but through lack of medical treatment. And so that's what we're seeing. That's what we fear we're going to see in Gaza. I don't think it's that straightforward, of course. I've already referred to the military problem, I think at least. Israel is expecting, and a lot of commentators are also expecting. And that is precisely that underneath Gaza, not least Gaza City, you have a warren. It's also been described as a spider's web of tunnels. We have the report of an elderly lady who was released by Hamas describing her experience. Now, I'm sure Hamas, that's what I would do with a hostage, isn't going to take someone from A to B. There you are, you come through the entrance, and we're going to march you straight to this hall, underground hall, where we're going to divide people up from different kibbutzes. I'm sure they took her all the way around the houses to get her completely disorientated. But from what we know, or at least what we think we know, there are something like 300 miles of tunnels under Gaza, under the Gaza Strip. And of course, what we're dealing with is not the sort of tunnels that were originally dug by Gazans to smuggle goods in from Egypt, which had a tendency to collapse. So they'd be bringing in fuel, bringing in, cement, bringing in medicines. And because they were shallow, they had a tendency to collapse. What we think we know is that they've been digging, 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 and reinforcing and reinforcing. So a lot of the cement that's come into Gaza to rebuild it after repeated Israeli airstrikes and incursions has gone into underground defenses. So we think that in these 300 miles of tunnels, what we've got is them all being reinforced with concrete, side and top. And what we also think we know is that some of these tunnels, far from being shallow as they might have been originally, go down something like 150 foot. Now, again, I don't know enough about military matters, and I haven't done enough reading, so I'm speculating here. But certainly, if I was Hamas, I would be looking at ensuring that I could protect my forces, my fighting formations, not only from how should you put it, conventional shells, but also conventional bombs. But I would be going and doing more if I could. And that is, I would be looking to digging sufficiently deep that even bunker busters wouldn't penetrate. My understanding is that bunker busters were designed for such facilities as Iran's nuclear sites, which are basically, dug down and then covered with layer after layer of steel and concrete. My understanding also is if you dig deep enough, you can actually protect yourself. Now, whether they've dug deep enough, I haven't got a clue. But that's what I would do if I was them. I wouldn't simply say, oh, well, that's deep. We don't need to go any deeper. They would be looking up the capability of what America has developed and will be doing their damn best to ensure that enough of their people survive to keep fighting. And I think that's why Netanyahu is talking about inch by inch. It's not only resistance fighters on the surface. It's resistance fighters underground who could appear all of a sudden out of this network of tunnels behind your lines. And, the entrance, they don't just have one entrance, they'll have many entrances. And they'll also have barriers. They'll also have many different layers in these tunnels. You're in a position, as I understand it, and you can imagine it, that. One defender that can keep off very large numbers for a very long period of time. And I would just add this particular piece of information because I think it's important that this isn't simply Netanyahu saying inch by inch, this is going to take a long time in order to survive as prime minister, in order to keep himself out of prison. I'm sure that's in his head. But this is, as my understanding goes, the unanimous position of the Israeli war cabinet. So it's a multi-party cabinet that's committed to this particular strategy. So there's no proposal to go in, to smash up, and then to pull out. This is a go in and destroy everything strategy. They want to kill every Hamas fighter. And the idea. That this will save, what is called the hostages. I think there are about 200 of them left alive. I think the figures are something like 40 have already died. These people are going to be used, they're going to be sacrificed. It's as simple as that. The idea, you can have it in, an adventure film that Israeli forces go under these passages, fight, shoot down these Hamas terrorists. And eventually come to some big room where all the Israeli, captives are all huddled together, and then they see it's an Israeli face. You can imagine the film. They all smile. They all reach out their arms, and the Israeli troops lead them to the light. It's just nonsense. Clearly, they're going to be dispersed, in terms of where they're being kept, and clearly. In terms of if they're using bunker busters, if they resort, as I, it's been suggested to me, chemical weapons, it's one possibility. There's no way you can spare hostages from Hamas fighters. There's no way you can separate the two. They're going to kill them all, not deliberately, but they're going to be viewed as what do they call it? Collateral damage. So in Israel. Yes, it's true that public opinion is deeply divided over the question of hostages. A lot of people want the army to hold back. Well, the army isn't holding back now. And that's why I emphasized, and I think it is important, the war cabinet. This isn't simply Netanyahu. This is Netanyahu and his former political opponents agreeing this strategy. Together, and they will be told by their generals, by anyone, with a brain, what this means. So, yes, potentially high casualties on the Israeli side for soldiers, but also surely total wipeout in terms of hostages that Hamas holds. Okay, so let's just take the wider picture. I've made the argument, and again, I've got no means of backing it up. It's more an assumption than knowledge that Hamas knew what it was doing strategically on October the 7th. It wasn't simply, oh, well, let's strike at Israel because we've got no choice. We've got nothing. We've got no idea. We just want to hit Israel. This military operation was a year in planning logistically. So, in terms of getting together paragliders, in terms of getting the tunnels together, in terms of getting, power boats together, in terms of training their army, this was a year in the making. Well, I'd also suggest that it must have been, therefore, at very least several years in the thinking. What are we going to do strategically? The idea that Hamas could take on Israel and win in a conventional war has never been a serious proposition. Everyone knows that. Indeed, we've had two Arab-Israeli wars. I remember vividly as a young person, the 1967 war, which Israel fought simultaneously against Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. And took them apart, as the name tells you, in 7 days. I mean, it took out the enemy air forces, I think within 2 days, or was it one day? Took the Golan Heights, took the West Bank, took Gaza, went into the Sinai. That's the military balance. So there's no way Hamas or PLO, Fatah can possibly beat Israel. Israel was backed by France. That's what they fought with in 1967, French aircraft, French tanks. Now they fight with American tanks, American aircraft, American backing. So, what was the thinking in Hezbollah? My guess is almost what's happening as we speak. And that is the rapprochement that America was promoting between Israel and various Arab countries, in particular. Israel and Saudi Arabia, that's come to an end. That's been derailed. More than that, though, what's been happening on the street? Well, we've got reports of Sisi, the army, ex-army dictator, the army-backed former general. Sponsoring a demonstration in Cairo that's variously reported as being 1 million or 1.5 million people. Cairo, by the way, is a very big city. I don't know, 20 million people. Either way, that's a huge demonstration. But what happened on this demonstration, as you would expect, is that it goes from being a government-sponsored demonstration to an anti government demonstration. Now, if you read Socialist Worker, this is entirely positive. But I don't think that this is the work of the revolutionary socialists who actually welcomed, remember, the Sisi military coup. Military coup against who? Against a Muslim Brotherhood president, a Muslim Brotherhood regime. Okay, they executed the former president. Does anyone think the Muslim Brotherhood has disappeared in Egypt? Well, of course not. They were out on the streets. They were the directing brain, at least of a good part of that 1 million, 1.5 million demonstration. And I would make the argument that that would be similar. I don't know about the Muslim Brotherhood and their strength elsewhere, but similar forces will also be mobilized in Beirut. In Amman, in Baghdad. So this isn't the left. The left maybe are there, but they're very marginal. And if you're Hamas, you'll also be calculating that in the street in the cities of Saudi Arabia, there will be a similar sentiment. I can't imagine anything other than that. It's not just a question of how many Palestinians. Are living in such countries. And in some countries, it's very large numbers. My expectation would be in a similar way, that if you look at Iran when it was under the Shah, anyone who had any sense knew that the alliance between America and the Shah was all very well, but the Shah was hated by the mass of the population. So, of course, it's true that Mohammed, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, is the effective ruler in Saudi Arabia and has been showing a bit of disloyalty to the global hegemon. What do the mass of Saudi Arabians think? What do the mass of the population of Saudi Arabia think? I think they no doubt, well, I've got no hesitation in saying my guess would be that they loathe the man. And indeed, I would make a reasonable guess that a good part of the elite, remember when he effectively came to power and confined thousands of them to these hotels and demanded money from them. He will not be Mr. Popular. Either way, to me, this is the calculation of Hamas, that by sacrificing thousands of their own fighters, by potentially sacrificing tens of thousands of Gazans, in terms of Israeli revenge, the whole region will be set alight and governments will fall and be replaced by something else that will be sympathetic to them. Now, that's a huge gamble, but I don't think it's crazy. I don't think it's an unreasonable view to take. It's possible, as has been suggested, that Iran gets dragged in. I think the word dragged is advisable. Iran doesn't want to be dragged into this war, but there are forces in the United States, there are forces in Britain, there are certainly forces in Israel that wants exactly such an outcome. And from a Hamas point of view, that wouldn't be a bad thing. From the point of view of the Ayatollahs, it could be an extremely bad thing, on the other hand. And we don't know what exactly the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah is, because Hezbollah will also be under pressure itself from its base. Why aren't we acting to save our co-religionists in Gaza while they're subject to genocide? Why don't we open a northern front? I don't think that anyone expects the Palestinian Authority to open a third front or an eastern front, but they too, I mean, are clearly unpopular and certainly under pressure. And so note, the Palestinian Authority will, does not criticize, the Hamas operation, expresses its sympathy, of course, with Gaza, calls Israel for what it is, a terror, a state. And they're doing that because they fear their own population. So it's conceivable, very conceivable, that the whole region could be set aflame. And, the longer that Israel's military operation lasts, the more Palestinians who die, the more likely such an outcome is going to be. Okay. So, showing you where opinion is, I think it is worthwhile quoting. I haven't got the exact figures, but someone could easily come up with them in terms of either chat or in the discussion. The recent UN General Assembly vote, and this is not binding on the UN. Any attempt to make it so would instantly get vetoed. We all know by who. It's called the United States. Nonetheless, the vote was overwhelming. And what we saw is a Jordanian resolution carried massively. I think the figure was something like 120. I haven't got it written down, but it's something along those lines. Who was against? 12. 12. Who did that include? Well, the United States. And then, as some journalists very helpfully listed out, some states I vaguely only heard of. I mean, I might be wrong, but one of them, for example, was Micronesia, in the Pacific, these islands, states like that that are basically bought and sold, and very few others by definition. One of them, of course, would be Israel. So 12, 12. And what you had is 45 abstentions, including close US allies. And the one I'd pick out is France. France actually abstained. So the so-called global South, I hate the term myself, clearly voted with Jordan. But America found itself isolated along with Israel. And so it doesn't surprise me that not only have you got massive demonstrations in the Arab world, massive demonstrations in the Muslim world. So in India, there are massive demonstrations. In terms of the reporting that I've seen by Muslim organizations, surprised me. I thought that it would be, for example, in Kerala, I read a report of 1 million people. And I thought to myself instantly, oh, that must be the Communist Party of India Marxist. No, it's a Muslim organization I'd never heard of. So elsewhere in the Muslim East, you see a similar picture. But look at north to Turkey, a not an Arab country, but a Muslim country. And you see Erdogan, the president, calling a demonstration a sea of Turkish flags, but with Palestinian flags. This is a solidarity demonstration in which he says that Hamas are not a terrorist organization. They're a resistance organization. And that Israel is an occupying power. Israel then withdraws its ambassador. This shows you public opinion. And it doesn't just show you public opinion in this so-called global South. After all, Turkey is a NATO member. Look at the demonstrations happening in the United States. Look at the demonstrations happening in, the cities of the United States' closest allies. So, for example, again, I don't know enough about it. We'll have an article, hopefully, in this week's paper. Demonstration led by Jewish people in New York. Great. Shows you that Jewish opinion in the United States is split, is divided. I would hope, and again, I'm not able to judge from here, I haven't read enough. But it would seem to me, under these circumstances, opinion will be more and more shifting away from an automatic loyalty to the Zionist government in Israel that used to be, at least have the image of being progressive, the Labour Zionism. We now not only have revisionist Zionism, we have religious Zionism, and we have, at least. I'm very reluctant to use the word for reasons comrades who are regular on this forum will know, but we have forces that at least ideologically have the stench about them of fascism. I mean, you just listen to some of the, the ministers or the Knesset members of some of these far right parties. These are blood and soil politicians. Plus, they're basically saying Gaza is ours, and we need to get rid of all Palestinians. And what they mean by all Palestinians, I would very much suggest, is not only in Gaza, but the West Bank, but also what has been called Israel proper, 1967 Israel. And what are they going to do with these people? This, I mean, I hate the to, I hate the comparison. But the final solution, what was that all about? It's precisely about the British authorities in Palestine, before World War II, closing it off to Jewish migration for good reason, because the Arabs didn't want to be taken over by colonists from Europe, but also the United States, also Britain, closing its doors on Jews. So they go for the final solution, killing. And I think that's where Israel potentially can go. So we see demonstrations, not only in New York, but Chicago. We see demonstrations breaking the law. They're banned in Marseille, in Paris, in Germany. We see demonstrations throughout Europe. Yesterday, for the third week in a row, we saw a demonstration in London. Now, I'm not in a position to judge the size. I mean, on some demonstrations, I sort of make an effort to time it and get a rough estimate of how many people are in the column, and in my own mind come out with some sort of figure. So I have to rely on others. And my guess would be, from what I'm told, in terms of how long it took to go by the demonstration from outside the BBC in Portland Place all the way down to Whitehall, comrades say that that was about, what, 30, 40, 50,000. I go, could well be that sort of figure. Last week, that's the week before, when we all got, at least some of us did, absolutely soaked. We had comrades, throughout the course of the demonstration, it took well over an hour to pass them by. And people were still coming to that demonstration. People were coming up Oxford Street as we left it. This is the only demonstration I've been on. They did pack people into, anyone knows the geography of London, into Marble Arch at the beginning. So it was extraordinarily packed. It started at just after 12 when that was the rally time. They said rally from 12 o'clock onwards. It left something like 12:05. So the figures that the police released was 100,000. And I was going, well, maybe. But when the organizers said, well, it was 300,000, I can believe it. We had our own comrade there. He has got no experience of the great demonstrations of the Iraq War and the lead up to that. He said a quarter of a million. Well, what's he know? What do I know? But it was big. That's the point. Huge. Yesterday's demonstration, I got a little bit more of an idea of its size. It left the embankment, next to the Thames. It banked way back. It went over Westminster Bridge. It looped around, came back up the Strand, and went up Whitehall into Parliament Square. It was massive. When the police announced their figure, 70, 50 or 70,000, I must admit, I spontaneously laughed. They claimed, well, they're no doubt right. They knew their own figures. They said they had 1,000 police on duty. Well, I was on the demonstration, and the idea that 1 out of 70 on that demonstration were police, that's just risible. No, it was a human flood. It was a human tide. And of course, the character is it's bringing up people who are politically inexperienced. It's bringing up people completely new to politics. It's everybody coming onto the street. So, of course, very large numbers of Muslims, very large numbers mobilized by the mosques. And you can tell those contingents by their slogans, by their dress, by the manner, the organization of them. But also, what was noticeable, and this is just worthwhile for comrades, who've been around politics for a little while, what was particularly noticeable and pleasing to me is a number of comrades in left groups now, young women wearing veils. I'm not approving of the veil, by the way, but the number of young women who are now members or supporters or sellers, at least, of the various larger left-wing organizations is very pleasing. And I'm sure on those demonstrations over the last weeks, not only has, the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Stop the War Coalition, won recruits, good, but so will left groups. Good. I'm pleased with that. Of course, I don't approve of the regimes of these organizations, people coming into politics and people coming into politics on the left is entirely positive. So yes, on the streets of London, the figure that at least some of the organisers have come out with is a lot more credible than the police. And I've heard the figure, for example, of 1 million, which brings you up to the sort of level that we haven't seen since the Iraq invasion way back earlier in the century. Okay. Having mentioned the UN vote, I think it's a useful way in to looking at the troubles of Sir Keir and the very pleasing sight of John McDonnell. We were wrong, by the way, in the paper last week. Two MPs spoke, and one of them was John McDonnell. And John McDonnell maybe is doing an electoral calculation in terms of his constituency and the general election that we're all expecting sometime next year. But also, I think he's being given courage by the mass protests around the world, by the UN vote, by the pressure that Sir Keir is under, not only from councillors resigning, but signing joint letters. So my figure is, in terms of it's not an up-to-date figure, something like 300 Labour councillors have signed a petition demanding a ceasefire, demanding something like the Jordanian UN General Council resolution. But on top of that, what's also given him courage is the story. I think it's got very good foundations. The story of Sir Keir facing big discontent on his front bench. Now, some of these people I have never heard of, but nonetheless, they're worth mentioning. I'm not sure of all their official positions, but one who comes to mind, who some comrades here will recognize for, I think, other reasons. And I think she's devolution minister, at least she might be, or shadow minister, I hasten to add, is Naz Shah. Now, we should remember Naz Shah because she's MP for Bradford, which is a very Muslim area in Britain. But it was also Naz Shah, from my memory, that defeated George Galloway. And it was Naz Shah that was one of the first victims of the witch hunt because she committed the crime of posting on. I don't know whether it was a tweet, but it was equivalent of a tweet of where she liked a cartoon. And my memory was it was a cartoon of the map of Israel superimposed on the United States with the headline Problem Solved. And of course, she got accused of being an anti-Semite and calling for the genocide. Of course, that's what always happens, isn't it? The genocide of the Israeli population. I don't think she actually was. What was noticeable about her particular case is that very rightly, Ken Livingstone, former mayor of London, former Labour MP, came to her rescue and said, Naz Shah isn't guilty of anti-Semitism. What she's guilty of is solidarity with the Palestinian people. That's her crime, and that's not a crime. That is something we should expect from anybody, not just a socialist, but anyone. I don't like the word myself, but anyone who stands up for justice or rights, not words that I use myself. And then it was Ken Livingstone that got it in the neck. And Naz Shah, I presume, as a good career politician, turned round and ate her own words and apologised and went on a racism awareness course. And of course, that left Ken Livingstone in the firing line. And we now see where this witch hunt has gone. I mean, some of us will remember all this nonsense about the Oxford Labour Club. Remember that? How that was full of anti-Semitism. sea mites, but it wasn't. We all remember, Jackie Walker. I can't work with that definition. Set up. Mark Wadsworth. You're collaborating. All this. And how the Labour left either kept silent on it or actually went along with the witch hunt. And I think we should remember those in the Labour Party that did side with Labour against the witch hunt, that did side with the first tranche of victims of this witch hunt, because there's clearly an establishment agenda to delegitimize any solidarity with Palestinians as they face genocide, to denounce that as anti Semitism. And so, we do have various shadow ministers. Maybe for, it's a cynical calculation in terms of their particular constituencies, but we have 13. Not only Naz Shah, but we have Paul Baker, we have Azil Khan, we have Rachel Hopkins, we have Sarah Owen, we even have Jess Phillips, someone on the far right, at least in my estimate, of the Labour Party. But they are joined by Anna Sawar in Scotland, by Sadiq Khan in London, Andy Burnham in Manchester. And yes, of course, the suspended Labour MPs, still Labour members, Diane Abbott and, of course, Jeremy Corbyn. But what's Suella Braverman? What's the Tories doing? Well, to my sort of not amazement, but to my sort of, oh my God, this is surely inevitable, but it's appalling, it's frightening. The logic of the witch hunt has gone from the Labour Party, which was a historic crime. The idea that the Labour left was, rife with anti-Semites, bollocks. These people were anti-racists, to use a phrase to their marrow. Good number of them that were victims, very understandably, of this Zionist witch hunt, of course, with Jews. Because, anyone who knows Jewish people will know that either you identify with Israel because Israel proclaims itself a Jewish state for Jewish people all across the world. You get a very large number, such as in New York, such as here in Britain, who say, no, as a Jew, I stand against this. And I accidentally found myself on the demonstration yesterday at the rallying point of Jew, the anti-Zionist Jewish bloc. So we not only had, Jewish Voice for Labour, we had a lot of other comrades there rallying at Cleopatra's needle, with huge big banners, Jews against genocide in Palestine and all the rest of it. So that's where we're at politically. But as I've said, we're also in the situation of where the Tories are trying to delegitimize this and spread the witch hunt out of the Labour Party into wider society, something that I feared, that I predicted. I always remember at a law meeting in some godforsaken community centre, which we had to get at the last moment because any venue that law booked and advertised was being threatened by bomb attacks. And so we had to, really search far and wide to get somewhere where we could meet. And I remember a comrade and a friend who got up and said, this witch hunt is bound to come to an end, bound to come to, because it's just so crazy. It's just so unbelievable. And my own response was, I'm not saying I've got such great foresight, but my response was, no, I don't think you're right. I actually think that in part because we on the left have created the ground, that we mustn't offend people. The worst thing you can do is offend someone, isn't it? Let alone on the grounds of race. That they found a weapon that they're now going to beat us with, and they'll carry on beating us. And that's what's happened. And so we've not only had comrades sacked from their jobs, you know, in terms of lecturers, local government workers, but we're now having a situation, if you use the slogan, is, you know, Palestine free from the river to the sea. That is being deemed as anti-Semitic. Well, that was the original slogan, of course, not only of Hamas, but the PLO. That is just saying, in other words, a single Palestinian state. And Hamas itself, my understanding is, and the PLO certainly was, that anyone here before 1947, this is some time ago, I readily admit, they are legitimate. People have come in after, have settled, especially on the West Bank, they're not. But I'm not going to write the charter of the PLO or the charter of Hamas, certainly. But they weren't threatening genocide. What they were saying is, and I don't agree with this, by the way, that what I would call the Israeli Jewish nation, what Moshe Makover calls the Hebrew nation, is a nation and should have national rights, not just religious rights. Now, I'm not going to elaborate on that. But I am saying that comrades and others in the resistance movement who use that slogan are not anti-Semites. Undoubtedly, there are anti-Semites, but that is not the content of that slogan. But what I would argue, and I think this is the crucial thing from a CPGB point of view, is even if it was. It's a legitimate political program that ought to have space in any society to advocate its solution. In the same way, I wouldn't be advocating banning Zionism, even though anybody in the 1930s who was intelligent and could see, or the 20s, I should choose my dates better. In the 20s, could look at Zionism and say this is not only going to bring you into conflict with the Arab masses, this is to invite a pogrom against Jewish people who are escaping a pogrom. And the reason I corrected myself in the 1920s is that's when Karl Kautsky reissued, rewrote his pamphlet, Are the Jews a Nation? That was a prediction that he made in that pamphlet. But we now have Suella Braverman. And others, even extending that to the word jihad. Now, on that demonstration yesterday and on other demonstrations, undoubtedly, in my opinion at least, the word jihad was not being used in some sort of religiously pure, contemplative fashion. I must carry out a jihad, so I stick strictly to the praying regime. I stick strictly. To the rules on diet, I really must pray very hard to Allah. I don't think that's what is being meant when people say jihad against Israel. It's quite clear, in my mind at least, what they mean by it is holy war against Israel. In my view, not my politics, but in my view, a legitimate political program that shouldn't be suppressed. But what we have is a Home Secretary, of course, playing to the gallery, playing up to the right-wing press, playing up in the run-up to a general election, you know, the sort of anti-woke stuff, veering over surely into an anti, not just Islamic rhetoric, but I'd say an anti-Muslim rhetoric. You know, to me, at least, I'm from a Christian background. I went to a Church of England school. I was told that the Crusaders were wonderful, brave people that were defending the word of God and bringing civilization to those damned Arabs. I mean, that's what I was brought up with. But the word crusade was something worthy. We'd go on a crusade against the evil of alcohol. We'd go on a crusade against the evils of Nazism. Just as our forebears, you know, actually went to Jerusalem and slaughtered the Jewish population, in the Third Crusade. That was Richard the Lionheart. Just as the Fourth Crusade sacked Constantinople. No, these were thugs. These were robbers. These were feudalists out for booty and war. They were warmongers, and they weren't bringing civilization. If anything that happened, it was that they brought civilization back from them, back with them to Europe. You know, the translations of ancient Greek philosophers and scientists and mathematicians that came to us via the Arabs, via the trade, but also the conquest of the crusade. But the point I'm making here is the word crusade is the Muslim Islamic equivalent of jihad, and that's what we're having. So yesterday, when I was on the demonstration, we distributed the papers to comrades for the demonstration. Apparently, and I'd be interested to hear from others, but I've got reports that the paper was very popular. The front page went down very well. Don't know about the articles, what was understood, what wasn't understood, who knows about that. But I was waiting precisely because of the pressure from Suella Braverman. When you heard the slogan, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. I was waiting for when the slogan was jihad, 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 for the police to barrel in. And indeed, that's what happened. I was at the end of Westminster Bridge. I was taking photographs for the Weekly Worker. There was a hit squad, a snatch squad, ready. And it barreled in and it held up the demonstration. And what was interesting to me, and this clearly is a commander's position, is having stopped the demonstration, the guys at the front, I would guess, of some Islamic organization, some mosque, that was their politics. They had a huge Palestine flag. Why they went in, I don't know. I say, followed them in, and the guys refused to back down. There was a guy in an anonymous mask, but the guy on the megaphone kept chanting, the crowd kept chanting. And the police clearly, and I would guess it wasn't the guys on the ground, it was the guys in the earpieces, said, back down, back off. And that's what they did. And so there were a few arrests yesterday, but given the turnout, you know, it's less than traffic, isn't it? The less you'd, with 1 million people, you'd expect, at a football, well, you can't have 1 million people at a football game, but you get my point, that you get any big crowd, you'd expect someone to get arrested for drunkenness, how many people have mental health problems, blah, blah, blah. So this was a very militant demonstration, a very disciplined demonstration, a very defiant demonstration. Third one in a week. Okay, so where's it going to go? I don't think anyone has a clue. I'm not going to speculate. You can speculate. It's worthwhile a little bit. You know, what's going to happen to the military regime? I call it a military regime in Egypt. What's going to happen to the royal regime in Saudi Arabia? What's going to happen to the royal regime in Jordan? At least you could speculate, couldn't you, that they must be, to using an Anglo-Saxon phrase, shitting themselves at the moment. What's Netanyahu determined to do? Seems like he's determined to conquer Gaza and leave nothing behind except rubble and bones. What happens to the 2 million Gazans? I mean, do they escape into Egypt? Do they die? Will people let them die? I just don't know. What does Iran do? What can Iran do? Does it, give the go-ahead to Hezbollah? All of these are imponderable. But what matters in terms of politics at the moment, I do think, is demonstrations, is protests. And the fact that we've seen, okay, small and symbolic attempts by left groups and militant trade unionists, for example, to blockade factories in Britain that are supplying Israeli arms or good stuff. I wish we could see Dockers doing the same thing. I think we should call upon Dockers, to do that. Find out what's in that container. If it contains stuff that's going to Israel, block it. That is something that workers can do. The more people on the streets, the better. The more labor councillors that develop a backbone, the more pressure there is on the shadow cabinet. Now, of course, we're told that Sakir is now playing with the big boys. And of course, his intransigence on this question is designed for consumption, not in Britain, but in America, in the White House. It's designed for, the US to say that Labour would be a trustworthy ally, as it looks like Labour will be elected. But we want that pressure in the Labour movement of where MPs, the miserable, cowardly MPs, not only in the Socialist Campaign Group, but in the rest of the PLP, actually develop courage because they fear losing their precious seats, their precious careers. And of course, they will express that in terms of humanitarianism. That's what we would expect them to do. I don't know. I'm not able to judge, what is going on in their heads. It doesn't matter to me. But the more pressure there can be, the better. So demonstrations do matter. They do affect. It's not the only politics that matter, as is claimed by the Socialist Workers Conway. What happens in CLPs matters. What happens in council chambers matters. What happens in Parliament matters. What happens at the ballot box matters. Okay, I've got, according to my own official schedule now, 3 minutes, and I would. Mike Pence dropped out. No surprise. Donald Trump still well in the lead in the Republican contest. And it looks like at least a distinct possibility, but it no stronger than that, that you could have a Donald Trump presidency after November. So he would be, if he was elected, he would swear the oath for a second time in January. What then happens in terms of world politics? Again, it shows we're in what the Chinese peasants used to curse their elite with. I wish you that you live in interesting times. I mean, what happens to Ukraine with a Donald Trump presidency? What happens to Iran under those circumstances? I mean, I just cannot imagine. My last one is just to note the resignation of Ash Regan. She came third in the contest to replace Nicola Sturgeon. She got, I think from my memory, 11% of the vote, and she's joined ALBA. That's the party of the former leader of the SNP, Alex Salmond, who hasn't been very successful in the ballot box yet, but with one MSP, member of the Scottish Parliament, and two MPs in Westminster. And it looks like with the strategy of the SNP coming to pieces with the blocking of the referendum, with the failure in terms of the courts turning around to the Scottish government and telling them what we'd told the left in Scotland all the way back, even before there was a Scottish Parliament. This Blair legislation does not give Scotland the right to self-determination. It doesn't. It hasn't. And that's what the courts told them. And so their independent strategy is come to a block. Do they go as they're advised by the SWP to an illegal referendum? Let's follow the example of Catalonia. Look how that ended up. That wasn't a success, it was a failure. And of course, we have the stench of corruption over Nicola Sturgeon, her husband, and the SNP itself, and adding to their woes, the rise of the Labour Party, not only in England, I don't know about Wales. I don't know what the opinion polls in Wales are, but in England, of course, Labour is way up there in the lead. But also in Scotland, Labour is chasing the SNP And a lot of Scottish seats look vulnerable to Labour. So far from their strategy of, well, let's make the next general election an equivalent of a referendum, and we'll judge it according to what number of MPs you get, because it's not going to be a situation, the number of votes. SNP doesn't get 50% plus of the vote, gets 50% of MPs, yes, because we got first past the post. What does that look like now? So the SNP is in a programmatic crisis. And so I would expect, yes, ALBA to grow, not necessarily into the dominant force, but further add to the crisis of the SNP. Anyway, I think I've said enough. So I'm 1 minute over schedule, Aaron.